this past quadrennium, the unity team of the Council of Bishops has met periodically with groups primarily concerned about sexuality-related issues. And I'm the chairperson of that unity team. And these conversations have been enlightening in many ways, but it also has raised some of the common things that such diverse groups have. And one of the things, as we've gotten closer to general conferences that they seem to hold in common, is a general sense of dread for general conference. Now, maybe the political process of it all, the opportunity to see new friends and see the old ones as well, and the renewed efforts to make change in the church energizes you more than fills you with dread. But for many people, general conference is dreadful. We all hold intense and deeply held beliefs about our faith and the church. Inevitably, from the position of deep love for Christ and the church. And I find that that's held in common also. But those intense and deeply held beliefs sometimes clash with fear and suspicion of others. I've come to believe that there are more conspiracy theories in the United Methodist Church about each other in different groups than there ever was about the assassination of John F. Kennedy and 9/11 put together and multiplied. But we've also experienced disappointment and pain. My experience as a delegate to General Conference was that I was often on the losing side of some of the key issues that were important to me. But when other delegates treated me with respect and actually worked to build relationships, it made the sting of disappointment and loss much less, and gave me hope that as the people of the United Methodist Church, we can demonstrate a more excellent way in the midst of all of our differences. I remember well a time when a delegate who was always on the losing side of an issue in a legislative committee wasn't really paying attention. It was late at night. And he accidentally voted against his own interest. And it was a very close vote. It was always like 14, 15 in all of these. And a person from the other side stopped the show and said, "I don't think you meant to vote that way. Do over." It may sound small, but it sticks out as one of many incidents when people cared and related to each other. Part of that is why I have become such a proponent of what we call holy conferencing. The fundamental concept of holy conferencing for me is how we make decisions is as important as the decisions we make. John Wesley identified Christian conferencing as a means of grace because it positions us to grow in faith and spiritual maturity, learning from each other and learning to love one another. And that doesn't sound dreadful to me. That sounds hopeful. He said, "Christian conferencing, are you convinced how important and difficult it is to order your conversation right? Is it always in grace, seasoned with salt? You will have the opportunity to learn some of the general principles of holy conferencing later this morning as delegates. And I encourage you in them so that our time together at general conference can be more of a means of grace and less of a dreadful time." The unity team of the Council of Bishops encouraged the General Commission on General Conference to have times for holy conferencing around some big issues before us. And they carved out three times, two of which are on the first full day, April 25th, in the afternoon. The first one occurs after the Episcopal address, the laity address, and the young people's address. And it will be an opportunity for people in cross-conference setting to share with each other about some of the concepts that have been introduced in light of the hope, the pain, and the movement of the Spirit in the church today. Following that conversation, again in cross-conference groups, There will be a discussion on homosexuality. Gil Rendell will introduce the questions with some guidance in how it is that we live together in the midst of such differences on this particular gulf between people in the church today. The third conversation will be on the global nature of the church, and that will be on Monday, April 30th. And again, there will be an opportunity to share what one has heard and how it impacts various geographical areas around the church. Three times to practice holy conferencing, to set a tone of respectful dialogue and relationship building, but it's not meant to be confined to those three times. And obviously, these aren't the only issues facing the delegates of General Conference, nor are they the only issues that raise deeply held beliefs and understandings of what it means to be the church in the 21st century. You have addressed some of the other issues, perhaps, that have caused some differences, even in your hallway conversations. Restructuring the church, specifically around changes to the general agencies. Reforming the Council of Bishops, including a non-residential bishop who aligns the residential bishop's work toward making more vital congregations. The Commission to Study Ministry has offered legislation regarding what is commonly called guaranteed appointments. The budget, you heard all about the budget yesterday. The global church in adopting a covenant in order to streamline the Book of Discipline. Sexualities, particularly homosexuality, which have been intensified over various events and activities in the last few months. A more specific and inclusive language about who can be a member, participate, receive sacraments, be admitted as baptized members and professing members, including gender, sexual orientation, gender choices, gender identity, abortion. A petition to ask General Conference to end the denomination's financial support of and membership in the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Divestment. We just had a question about that. Immigration, calling for more comprehensive immigration reform or support of the DREAM Act. A call to the end of the conflict in Afghanistan, a call for financial reform and equality, environmental awareness and movement toward a smaller carbon footprint on the part of congregations and the U.S. government, to affirm the opposition to bullying, and then a call for greater civility in public discourse, which hopefully will be demonstrated by us in all of this diversity. Now, any one of these issues can make your mind explode, or spoil an otherwise good dinner party. But we're going to put them all together at General Conference and be the people of the United Methodist Church. So will it be dreadful? Or will it be hopeful? It's up to you. The panel that we have today to talk about holy conversation includes some wonderful people. They're just great folks. Aaron Hocken is the General Secretary for the General Commission on Religion and Race. Mike Slaughter is the lead pastor at Ginghamsburg United Methodist Church in Tipp City, Ohio. And Stephanie Hickson is the co-executive director of Just Peace Center for Mediation and Conflict Transformation. Tom Lembrick is the vice president and general manager of Good News Magazine. And Bruce Robbins is the lead pastor at Hennepin Avenue United Methodist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the center of the world, obviously. So I welcome all of you here. And my first question to you is really for you just to say a word about, are you dread-filled or hopeful? And what experience have you had with holy conferencing that might give you hope as we go into General Conference? Jump right in there.
I would say both and on the dread and hope. I one of the things I've seen is United Methodist, we do more political conferencing than holy conferencing. And one of the ways that I've really experienced holy conferencing in our church, though, was 1992 in Louisville. And I was on the legislative section of social concerns. And I was, Tech Sample and I became the main voices in debating and going for the vote on the abortion issue. And I'm against abortion, and Tex took the opposite side. And I was young at that time, and he came up after our first meeting and said, "Who the hell are you?" And he said, he goes, "I bet you think I don't believe in Jesus." And I said, "Well, no." And we began sharing our Jesus stories. And so every day in the legislative section, we stood on opposite sides. And every night, we went out to a microbrewery and shared beer together. And what was really exciting was he and I became great friends during that conference. And we really began to hear the Spirit. And what I've learned, I love the Methodist Church because, you know, all of what God has to say isn't in the 998 pages of my Bible. Is that the Holy Spirit will lead you in things to come. And it's in this spirit of humility and listening to each other that I begin to learn through my friend Tex, when we would go have beers together every night and the caucus groups would want to talk to me or him, and they would stand at the edges because they didn't know how to approach us. So that is my hope.
Good morning. I'm Bruce Robbins, as was said, and for the 90s and until 2003, I had the challenging task of being the General Secretary for the Commission on Christian Unity. That may even be a more challenging task in these days, but a couple of illustrations of holy conferencing. After the 1996 General Conference, it was apparent that there was a lot of division within the unity of the United Methodist Church, not just between churches, which the commission had earlier focused upon. So we began a set of dialogues, and I recruited the help of a dozen people, more conservative and more liberal, evenly divided. And we had Maxie Dunham and Don Messer helping choose the people, and then an important dialogue on called In Search of Unity, Homosexuality and the Unity of the Church. And after two 48-hour sessions, Billy Abraham and I drafted a report, which is still, I think, a helpful resource on the issues to the church. It becomes more difficult as time goes on, though. In 2004, you may remember, a late night during the General Conference, two young adults came to me and others at the Christian Unity Commission and asked for some dialogues on this issue because of the dividedness in their legislative committee. That led to late night conversations of sharing of stories that were passionate with people you might know, such as some of the ones on the dialogue. And then it led to a very difficult morning because of the votes taken, and then lots of discussion on amicable separation and on church unity, leading the next morning to me being asked to address the General Conference about Christian unity and how it's related to brokenness, and to tell something about the dialogue. One of the more difficult things I was doing, and Bill Hinson, who had been a part of that dialogue, came and stood beside me during that time. The challenge of holy conversation is that without change, it can lead toward frustration and some despair when the issues seem to be life and death for people, and sometimes can be. And finally, in 2011, last year, I joined with others from Minnesota Conference, and some of us signed a statement saying that we would offer the blessing of Christian marriage to all prepared couples who came to us at that point. And that statement went to other annual conferences, as you may know, and became becomes an increasingly difficult conversation within our church. And the reason is because it puts us, many of us, in a very difficult dilemma. We hold a precious covenant as United Methodist clergy within this church, a covenant that we deeply hold, and for many of us, dates back generations and generations of Methodist clergy in our families. And to break that covenant is extremely difficult. At the same time, we, all of us, in one way or another, hold an even more precious covenant, a covenant to Jesus Christ, and a covenant that calls for us to discern and pray about what Christ asks of us as United Methodists and as Christians, a covenant that's sealed by our baptisms. And so this dilemma we face causes me, I wouldn't use the word dread, but I do realize the challenge, and there's a level of fear and despair within many people coming to General Conference, I'm sure from all sides, about how in a church we are gripped by that challenge this difficult conversation poses for us.
I would like to express appreciation to Bishop Dick and the Bishop's Unity Task Force. That has been one opportunity for Holy Conferencing that has been very meaningful to me as we, from Good News and other groups within the Renewal and Reform Coalition, have had an opportunity to meet with your task force and feel that our concerns have been respected and heard and responded to with integrity. And so that's an example for us. I experienced Holy Conferencing in my involvement in the Wisconsin Annual Conference several times through study committees on the issue of homosexuality. The thing that I think helped the most in that situation was the fact that we were meeting over an extended period of time, and we had multiple opportunities to share with each other and develop relationship across time. That's going to be next to impossible at General Conference because of the way that it works. And so I'm not as hopeful in terms of how Holy Conferencing can really help us. I think that it's important for us to remember how we treat one another, and I like, Bishop, your statement of how we make decisions being as important as the decisions that we make. The respect that we give for one another and the understanding that we give for one another being very important. When I hear my colleague and friend Bruce talk, I must say that I experience a certain amount of dread and frustration because it seems like some of the issues that we face, and not just the issues around sexuality, but there are other issues as well, are at least in the foreseeable future, unresolvable. And being the kind of person that I am, I like resolution. I like things to be solved and brought to a conclusion. And so it's hard for me to deal in a situation where we have this suspended problem always, and it never seems to get resolved. Holy Conferencing, I think, can help us to deal with that because it allows us to talk about our deeply held convictions and the reasons why we hold them, and to understand one another and build relationship in the midst of disagreement that can sustain us even though the disagreement continues.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Hickson, as Bishop Dick had said, from Just Peace Center for Mediation. And as I listen to my colleagues here at table, I don't know about you, but even though I'd given thought to this question about dread and hope, I can feel the work going on in my belly. I can feel it. And so if I'm to be honest, I can say that that kind of anxiety, that kind of, I don't know that I would call it dread, but certainly a certain amount of fear is present. But at the same time, as one who is washed in the waters of baptism, died and raised again to new life, I can be about none other than to be hopeful in the presence of my sisters and brothers in Christ. I feel a particular responsibility to be continually hopeful on behalf of the church, which has betrayed many of us at many turns. If we're honest, that has happened. And so my prayer is a prayer that I pray when I facilitate many conversations. I'm humbled to be in the midst of many of you at times when the conversations are most difficult, and my hands are trembling, and my heart is deeply hurting just as yours are. But when I'm in your midst, a prayer that comes to mind many times is this for us, that we may know that God's embrace is strong enough, wide enough, and yet tender enough to carry the important conversations that are put before us. And I've experienced that in general conference. I've experienced that in annual conference. I've experienced that in a local church when I'm sitting in a room full of people who've said to the district superintendent, we'll take anybody in the church except a woman to be our pastor. And then I'm called to love. Stephanie is not able to do that. But by God's grace together, we were able to find some way to journey in love together. So I feel compelled that I can do no other but be hopeful, but am also cognizant of how important it is for us to prepare to be in one another's presence. You mentioned relationship over time. Mike, you mentioned relationships. Bruce, you talked about relationships over time. It's sort of an unlikely reality that we put ourselves in, isn't it? To expect these deep relationships to be such that we can hold these kinds of holy conversations. We're making steps to extend those conversations in other places so that hopefully we bring our best selves when we come together for the decision-making at General Conference. I remain hopeful that I won't be labeled, oh, that woman, that blasphemous woman who came into our congregation, and that you won't be labeled in, quite frankly, if I confess to you many of the names that have come into my mind about some of my brothers and sisters. The questions that we ask of one another are important. How we frame the discussion is important. That we have carved out time to be with one another apart from the time when we will actually cast a vote is important. That we spend time on the edges with whatever beverage of choice is important. I believe that God's embrace carries all of that. And I look forward to the journey together, but let's work with our mind, body, soul, spirit together to prepare well.
I would affirm all of the concerns and the feelings, the challenges that my colleagues here have shared in the work that the General Conference has given me and the agency that I serve to do. We are tasked with sustaining a difficult conversation every day. And so I have lots of experiences in what it takes to have difficult conversations, particularly about the areas of race, but not exclusively. And so I've had experiences where I have seen those conversations be very productive and move a whole community forward, and I have experienced conversations that have been challenging and have moved communities back and have increased the sense of despair, anger, hurt, wounding that are experienced in that. As I reflect, however, on probably one of the most significant experiences that I've had with Holy Conferencing, what comes to mind is not an experience that I've actually had in the church. It was one that happened before I became, you know, a staff person employed by the church, when I worked for a member of Congress, and we had some conversations in a district area around change, rezoning, in the midst of a changing demographic in that community. And the people came together with a sense of real anger about how the changes were happening, who was in, who was out, who would benefit from the rezoning, and what types of ways in which others would be further harmed, the economics of a situation like that, all of the same types of things we talk about in the church, just in a different context. Central to that conversation was the location of a high school and the impact that the change in zoning would have in the makeup of that high school, and how the people of that neighborhood, many of whom were people of color, would have to be bused away from the school that was in their neighborhood because of the rezoning, and the anxiety that they felt about that. And while the folks came together with banners and speeches and signs and lots of animus about the situation, the students of that high school also met. And they had conversations, but they had a different type of conversation. They had a conversation about their relationships together. They had a conversation about their vision and their hope for the future and their lives and who they were called to be. And as a result, they were able to come up with some suggestions for a zoning plan that were outside of what was even being considered by the people who had the task to do this work. They changed the context of the conversation. And because of it, I believe that they were able to usher in a season of holy conferencing, even though the conversations that they were having were not necessarily religious or spiritual in nature. There was a spiritual thing that happened in that community. And that experience will always stay with me. There were a few things that I think were present in that conversation that made it holy, that have influenced me and that I would commend to you as we take on these difficult conversations. And one is the what are the real issues? We've talked a lot about our concerns, our crisis, the problems that we need to fix, the ideas and the preferences that we bring. But all of that is a symptom of something deeper. It's the quality of the community and our life together as a community. And when we're honest about what we're really discussing, we usher in holy conferencing. When all of our struggles, our anxieties, our fears about the future that are manifested in our budgets and in our pensions and in our structure are allowed to be deeper in those conversations about how do we build relationship together? How will this help to elevate the quality of the community that we are together? We usher in a moment of holy conferencing. So the context of our conversations is important. Sometimes in order to solve the concerns that we have, we've got to have conversations that are different than the ones that we're used to having. And the language that we use to talk about those things that are heavy on our hearts. How does the language we use, the words we use, help to perpetuate our struggles as a church? Or how does the language we use help to bring community together? When all of our language is about crisis, when all of our language is about my position, when all of our language is about this demographic or this group, how does that language create a reality in which we continue to struggle? And so I believe that part of our task in having difficult conversations and ushering in a time of holy conversations requires that we are attentive and responsible for the words that we use and the impact that those words use, those words have, and how we either build up the quality of our relationships together and usher in a future that we all feel called and compelled toward, or how those words, those phrases, those ideas tear down our community and keep us stuck in the crisis that we see ourselves in. It took me going outside of the church to find that. But the lessons of that will help us to be relevant to a world where we need to be in the rezoning meetings, bringing the ethos of the United Methodist Church and the mission. We need to be in all of the places where the people who are not necessarily in this room are. And if we can listen and learn from the ways in which holy conferencing is happening all around us, perhaps we can do a little better to allow that holy conferencing to happen within us.
Thank you. I told you these are great people. And now, just to put a little finer point on it, for each one, to think about a specific concern that you have, an issue, for want of a better term, that is coming before General Conference. And how is it that you hope, and how will you help to make sure that those conversations are healthy and holy? So what's one specific concern that you bring, and what's your role in helping to make that conversation holy?
My biggest concern is that we don't get stalemated, and that we really, what I believe we have to go as a church is downsize. That every organization competing in this postmodern world knows that you have to get leaner and meaner. And I look at General Motors and, you know, no more Pontiac, no more Oldsmobile. How do we do that, however, and still have the inclusivity? So to me, what's really important is I'm someone that really wants to downsize, but it's very important that I listen, to everyone at the table to get a sense of how we can do that strategically, but inclusively at the same time. That's my struggle.
Of course, I carry with me anticipation of the debates over human sexuality at General Conference, and it affects many, many other issues as well, including the worldwide church discussions we're going to have where there's such great need for change. And I think what I bring to conference is a pretty profound hope, and that hope's based upon the powerful and good relations which I have seen between people who hold deeply different and deeply held convictions between them. I also see it in the appreciation of Bishop Dick and others encouraging the listening and the holy conversation. But most importantly, I think it's in a confidence that a confidence in our gospel message. Just one little illustration is that, like some of you, I'm trying to outline a sermon for January 29th. And one of the lectionary passages, the one I've chosen to preach on, is the 8th chapter of 1 Corinthians. And it appears to be a chapter about whether or not to eat meat, and whether that meat is blessed by idols or not. But what Paul says in the end of that, no matter how deeply held your convictions are on any issue, and he's using that as an illustration, it's the recognition that instead of all that, it's the presence and love of Christ in each person that is what makes the difference. And if we can keep that at the center of all of our discussions and all we do, and recognize that Christ and within each other, how can God, however it happens, how can God not prevail?
I think there are quite a few issues that we could talk about, and I'm sure that we're not discussing and debating the issue per se. But what I'd like to say is that I appreciate Aaron's point about the fact that many of the issues we discuss are really surface manifestations of deeper issues. And I think that particularly, for example, with the issue of sexuality, from an evangelical perspective, we have fears that were the church to change its position, it would be an abandonment of Scripture and an abandonment of what God is calling us to be as a church. Now, I'm sure that Bruce and people that are in your particular camp would say that there are deeply held values underneath that issue for you as well, or that we need to discuss. And I think that one of the ways that we can move forward is to acknowledge those deeper issues and to begin discussing why these things are so important and why they're so deeply felt, and be able to honor some of the underlying convictions that inform our views on these issues, so that we can understand why people believe the way that they do. And so in my writing, I've tried to get at some of that, why these issues are important to us. Why is this an issue that we care deeply about? Why are we so obstinate about our perspective? And I think it's that kind of discussion that can help perhaps move us a little bit forward as well.
I'm not sure that I would name issues. I think for me there are concerns about limiting ourselves to talking about issues. Again, with appreciation for the perspectives that have been shared thus far and Aaron's insight, I think that the way in which we approach one another at General Conference will make a difference. One of the advisors, a deeply soulful woman who brings great wisdom from her own nation, has taught those of us at Just Peace that it's very difficult to get to a good place in a bad way. It doesn't mean that God can't do that in spite of us, because that's God's way sometimes. However, I think that the season is perhaps upon us now, as Aaron has invited us to think about, to maybe approach our conversation even with some different questions and prepare ourselves perhaps a little differently. What would it mean if there is some deep engagement around the question not only of making disciples for Jesus Christ, but what discipleship means? What would it mean if we balance our conversation about the Great Commission also with the conversation about the Great Commandment, and what the depths of that means in each of our communities and our lives? And as Mike has indicated, approach one another with a sense of listening for that faith experience of the other and of other communities. And it will take time for us to do that. So one of the reality checks that I have as a facilitator is that holy conferencing is not a magic endeavor. It's hard work. Holy conversation is hard work, sustained by relationships over time. We seek to do no harm. We seek to do good. We seek to stay in love with God. But at times we have witnessed we do harm. We are quite unholy in the ways we engage. So I invite us to imagine as we prepare and think about whatever the content of the deepest concerns is that or are that we have approaching General Conference. Imagine the kinds of questions that you might have, curious questions of the other, someone that you have identified that might just not have the same experience that you do. But use your imagination. What are some of those creative questions about relationship that might allow us to speak with one another around some other things that leads us to opening up new questions about the so-called issues that concern us?
Like Stephanie, I don't know that there's any one particular issue that stands out for me. I have concern for all of them. But I do have a commitment to seeing equity, to seeing participation, and access to participation in all of the life of the church for all people as values that need to be affirmed and need to be made explicit in our decision-making processes. I think one of the challenges that we face is that while we desire, I believe, with our hearts to do holy conferencing, general conference is not necessarily structured to bring that about in the most helpful way to our church. And so it limits our ability to really be the agents of transformation in the world that we seek to be. However, it is what we have. How do we have conversations that will give us a future that is distinct from our past if we keep doing it the way we've always done it in the past? And tweaking to make improvements to past-based practices doesn't necessarily give us a new future. And so we're confined in a way, and I have that grumbling in the stomach about that. So maybe we need to structure more times for the beverage of choice meetings and less on some of the old past-based ways in which we come to decision-making. And so I say that to say, related to the question, the concerns, I will take, for example, a concern we had, a conversation that was held here, I guess it was yesterday, the days are all running together now, but the conversation around restructuring the church, and there were questions about who's in and who's out, inclusion, that sort of thing, and so there was a call for trust, and there was some uneasiness within me about that, because I believe that in addition to trust, we need to have a conversation about trustworthiness. And we have to have it on both sides. And yet we're not structured to have those full conversations that will actually bring us to a new place. And so I have anxiety about whether we'll make decisions that are equitable and allow everyone in the church to have an opportunity to exercise their right to full participation in the church, because we haven't structured ourselves for the type of holy conversation, holy dialogue that would bring that about. And so I do feel some anxiety around whether equity, whether justice, whether our commitments, our values of a church can actually be lived out in the context of this, in across all of the issues that we have, all of which are valid. We need to be talking. It's good and right for us to have a conversation on whether it's time to downsize or not. It's good and right for us to have a conversation about whether we need to shift our stance on LGBT LGBT inclusion in the church. It's good and right for us to have conversations around what will it take for us to be fully relevant and to develop a new generation of leadership and how we reframe our systems for that. We need to have all of those conversations, and we need to be attentive to the ways in which we structure those conversations so that our deepest values of a church actually get lived out in our actions. And so for me, it's the underlying value question that is beneath all of it that's important.
All right. Very quickly, this is a one-sentence answer. What do you hope to experience from the presiding bishops around holy conferencing, from other delegates, or from yourself? Quick. Don't do the same order. Just start somewhere.
I think what I'm looking for is fairness and respect. Humility.
Honesty.
openness to others in the Spirit.
Grounded in the Spirit, open heart, meaning courage.
All right, they did it too. 1/7. Okay, and all of that was so that we could spend a little time hearing from you. Now, I want to remind you that we're not debating some of these more controversial issues, but really talking about how we talk about them, how we can come together at General Conference and Holy Conference. So I'll start over here, if you come forward to that mic. Try it again. No? Help is coming.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. They tell me they need a new battery here. Cynthia Astle, project coordinator for United Methodist Insight. God willing, this will be my 7th general conference. So as we say in Texas, this ain't my first rodeo. And my observation has been that the motivating force in general conference is all about the power. Who gets to say who's in and who's out? And so my question for the group, and there have been some excellent responses to this, but my question for the group is there a way that you can hold one another accountable to those moments when the temptation to power overcomes the goal of holy conferencing?
Maybe two of you like to respond to that?
I think, thank you, Cynthia. I think this is, as we resonated with Aaron's statement about trust and trustworthiness, it's very difficult to hold one another accountable in such a setting. And I think that, one of the key things that we can do in addition to this relationship building and all the preparation that we have in prayer and bathing ourselves in prayer and opening ourselves to one another, we have to be very practical, and that is to be committed to one another in that. And a covenant and some kind of very specific commitment to that covenant and ways in which we can hold ourselves accountable to that relational covenant, if you will, I think is key. If we're not explicit about the values and what it is that we hold common, that we say is to be the holiest of our conversation, what is it? What is it that is holy? What does it mean to be holy? If we're not explicit about that and name those values and then also have ways to gently challenge one another when that does not happen, or have a way in the general conference to pause our proceedings and our decision-making if we're not faithful in that path, and then return to that with God's grace. I think that's key. I think we have to give importance. It's what we know from our biblical faith, and it's what we know in communities of faith, in our closest relationships, that we have to work with all the time, and that is a commitment to one another and a covenant.
I would say that it's difficult to hold one another accountable when there's not relationship present. And yet there are some places where there are relationships. I'm thinking of our general rules, the first of which is to do no harm. I wonder what it would be like if delegations had covenants where those relationships already exist, that as we come, as we stand at the mic in general plenary sessions on the floor, that we will hold ourselves accountable for our language and to do no harm. And when we hear, even if we agree, someone saying something that does harm or impacts someone in a way that tears down community, that we will call each other on it. And so I think that accountability play the accountability has to happen in the places where their relationship, and I think the relationships need to be rooted in a commitment, as Stephanie said, to those principles that we hold as United Methodists.
Thank you. And later on, some of you will receive a copy, I believe, of the bookmark that all of us will be given. And I'm hopeful that from presiding officers and legislative groups to the presiding bishops in the plenary, that we will continue to come back to what these are. Every child or every person is a child of God. Listen before speaking. Strive to understand from another's point of view. Strive to accurately reflect the views of others. Speak about issues. Do not defame persons. Disagree without being disagreeable. Pray in silence or aloud before decisions. Let prayer interrupt your busyness. Strive to accurately reflect the views of others. So we will be reminded of some of these important principles when those moments, and you're right, they're power moments, come before us. I've given recognition and then recognition over here. And we'll see. Okay, I got three in the pipeline.
Ken Carter, Western North Carolina Conference. And this is a question for which I do not have an answer. Could you imagine placing this in the context of our conversations around call to action, the ministry study, where we are trying to reframe our organization and our ordering of ministry from a missional perspective? Could you imagine our approaching human sexuality from a missional perspective? And could you imagine the adaptive challenge being giving this work to the people and to the annual conferences? And I guess I'm hopeful that, as important as relationships are to me, and I have wonderful relationships across this church, across many different ideologies, that what's important is that we give this to the people. And I'm hopeful that we are consistent across our conversations, and hopeful that maybe reframing it from a missional perspective will allow us in the future to accomplish our mission. And I believe our current language is affecting our more liberal churches and our more evangelical churches. And again, this is a question for which I have no answer. I'm just wondering if we can see it in a different way. That's my hope, and I wonder if any of you could see that.
I'm going to call on Tom and Bruce to each briefly answer that question.
Ken, I think that's a great question. As I've thought about this issue over many years, I think that part of the reason it's so difficult to resolve the issue is because we almost approach it from different worldviews. And how we would define the mission of the church in relationship to this particular challenge is vastly different. So I think that it's helpful to think about how do our words and positions on human sexuality inform or further the mission of our church. We may find that we're then just pushing the disagreement another level lower, which actually I think is healthy because it's getting closer to really where the root issues are. But I don't necessarily believe that that would in and of itself resolve the issue, or the disagreement, I should say.
Our annual conference has two gospel imperatives that our bishop has put before us, to cultivate spirituality and to reach new people. And just a little story in the context of those missional imperatives for us. There is a young woman, a woman in my parish, who is seminary trained, who had left the church out of frustration over human sexuality issues. She has become more active and has been a gifted leader in worship services, and has wanted to pursue a calling to ordain ministry, which the church has affirmed. However, she has a person that she wants to marry. They've been together for 12 years, a man. It's a straight couple. But they have a deep commitment that they're not going to marry until everybody can marry in the state of Minnesota. And that's not yet happened. So the challenge she faces is that commitment. They've been together for 12 years and want to marry as soon as they can. Yet as you could understand, the district committee of ordination, Board of Ordained Ministry, struggles with the fidelity in marriage and celibacy and singleness of a person who's living together, committed to be married, but choosing not to until everyone get married for a justice issue. It poses a big challenge for us. It's an example of this issue's interrelationship with a missional perspective, I think.
Okay. Now, we probably have time for one more question. I apologize.
Jen Ilo, a lay delegate from Baltimore Washington Conference. General Conference 2008 was a very, very painful general conference for some of us. In terms not just of the votes, but of the language that was leveled against gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. I am supportive of having holy conversation. I am fearful that in the context of those conversations, those people, you know, who are delegates, who are also gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, may experience great pain from language that may be used, despite the admonitions to do no harm and to treat everyone as a child of God. So my question is, how will care be taken to ensure that gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender delegates are not harmed, and if they are, to care for them after the conversation?
Thank you. I'm going to take this question myself. Inflammatory language has been something I have spent a lot of time thinking about. And I have commitments that Just Peace is going to help prepare presiding bishops a little bit for when inflammatory language occurs on the plenary. But I want to challenge you to think about what inflammatory language is too. So if I say, I don't really like coming to Tampa, is that inflammatory? Or if you're the head of and this is your home, you might think that's inflammatory. But if I need to be able to give reasons why maybe I don't like to come to Tampa, and we need to be very careful that in those reasons we do not hurt other people. When we call people names, when we defame groups or individuals, then we need to have ways that we call the group back to understanding that how we talk about each other is as important as whatever decision is before us. But inflammatory language is pretty tricky, because if you don't like what somebody else is saying, that may not be inflammatory language, even though it's hurtful. But if there is a point to that language that is attacking individuals and groups, it's really important that not occur. And I'm hopeful that Just Peace is going to help us make sure that we have good ways to be able to address on the floor. We've come to the end of our time this morning, and I want to thank all of the panelists for their rich replies and to these questions. Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Yes, we're almost to the end of our time.
My name is Sue Laurie. I have no role or reason to be here, but I believe so much in holy conferencing. You've seen me do it for years and years and years. One of my favorite stories was with Tom Lambrick in the back of the General Conference. Doing is making my task very difficult. I said, do you know? And now this is to the whole panel. I'm glad you do remember, because we shared communion then. You accidentally ate the bread before the cup finally came by, because that happens. And I was able to tear off my bread, and we had communion. And this is holy conferencing, and we've done it. And I've done it in lots of places. But to the panel, all of you, yes or no, have you seen evidence of the Holy Spirit vital, transforming the world, making disciples for Jesus Christ? Have you seen that evidence of the Spirit in the ministry of gay and lesbian people who are United Methodists? Have you? Have you? Yes, you have. I know you have. Just nod your heads. Like Tom, that day, I said, Tom, you know there's gay and lesbian clergy that are doing good ministry. And you nodded. And that was in 2000. So I have a concern about inflammatory language, but I have a greater concern about inflammatory silence. Inflammatory silence empowers the status quo. It hurts the integrity of the church. Inflammatory silence stops that transformation of the world for Jesus Christ. This is about leadership in the United Methodist Church, and we need to do this, and we can do it. And I have great hope. I'm the hope person at General Conference. This will be my fifth. We're tired of telling stories. We're tired of talking about homosexuality. I get it. We've come in good faith and told these stories and over. So some of the hurtful language I've heard just now is, we need more time. We need more time. We need to build relationships. So many of our folks who have taken that time and built those relationships are long gone. So we get a different set of people on the panel and we start again. And this is how we maintain the status quo, and this is how we undermine the transformation of the world. We need leaders in the United Methodist Church. We need to sit like Tom and I did at Communion in the 2000 General Conference, which ironically was that General Conference when we asked for forgiveness and repentance on racism. And I knew one day we will do this. But in 1996, I heard one of my mentors who was gay named Rod from California say, I'm so tired of telling my story. Let's go ahead. Let's stop the inflammatory silence. Let's stop with the code. Stop the code. This distrust that Jay Berm mentioned, he was one of the best. He mentioned it. He said, if you haven't noticed, there's some distrust. That was one of the most authentic, genuine, vital, renewing things I've heard since I've been here. And we can do it. We can do it. This General Conference. We've told our stories for many, many years. Let's not resort back to language of let's have a dialogue team. I salute my folks in Western Pennsylvania who taught me about that language in the 90s. Thank you.
Thank you.